Hello, and welcome to Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne here at 88.5 KRFY, community radio for North Idaho. I am Dr. Joanne, and I hope you'll enjoy the medical topics that I've chosen to present at 8 a.m. the first Monday of every month, with a rebroadcast at 8 a.m. on the third Monday. You can listen to our shows on your radio at 88.5, or stream the show and every KRFY show at krfy.org. This show is also available as a podcast at krfy.org or wherever you listen to podcasts. Your friends can even stream us from anywhere in the world at krfy.org. The monthly topics discussed here will feature the medical designations for each month. Since this is March, today's show will feature colon, or more specifically, colorectal cancer. I have Dr. Nathan Canning, a general surgeon at Bonner General Hospital and Bonner General Health, and Susan Fay, a colon cancer survivor, here with me today. This is such an important discussion as colorectal cancer is both preventable and treatable. Also here with me in the studio is Susie Perez, who many of you know from our The Morning Show. Hi, Susie.
Hi, Dr. Joanne. How are you doing today?
I'm fine. I'm glad to be here and talk about this very important topic.
All right. KRFY is very fortunate you stepped in to host this show, Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne, a great addition to the KRFY local programming schedule. And I just want to take a moment and let the listeners know a little bit about you, Dr. Joanne Royans. You are a retired pediatrician from Columbus, Ohio, who worked primarily in private practice for over 30 years. But you also worked in the Learning Disabilities Clinic and in the outpatient clinic at Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio. You served as media spokesperson for the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Ohio chapter, and the Central Ohio Pediatric Society, appearing on TV, radio, and in print media. It really set you up for this show, right?
Well, it did, and it was always interesting when, because there was one, like, health topics that you could search online, and people would go, I read your information about, you know, controlling my baby's temperature, and it was just happened to be on an online search engine.
So we want to really thank you for your dedication to the subject of health, medicine, and wellness.
Thanks, Susie, for that introduction. Now I get to welcome the guests who are joining me today. Dr. Nathan Canning is a general surgeon at Bonner General Health. He did his medical school training at the University of Kansas and his residency in general surgery at Oregon Health Sciences University. He's been in Sandpoint for 16 years, enjoying the beautiful Northwest. Here with me also is a friend and a great pickleball player, Susan Fay, who was diagnosed with colon cancer in 2021, and she has been an amazing athlete now for her rehab and can beat us all on the pickleball court. Just a little history as we begin. I always think it's interesting to find out why March is Colon Cancer Awareness Month. Well, actually, on February 29th, 2000, which actually is coming up, February 29th, 2020, so this is the 20th anniversary, Bill Clinton, by presidential proclamation, called March Colon Cancer Awareness Month. As many of you know, I thought I'd just add this interesting fact. Many diseases and cancers now have colors associated with them. We did heart, and heart is red, of course. Pink, we know, for breast cancer. And blue is for colon cancer. So if you wear blue in the month of March, just remember that you are helping us spread colon cancer awareness. I've read that about 150,000 people are diagnosed each year with colon cancer. Although it's a cancer that primarily affects older people, that is age 50 and older, so I guess I am included in that group, the incidence is now increasing in young adults. And since 60% of deaths from colorectal cancer are preventable by screening, it's so very important that we all learn the signs, symptoms, and prevention strategies. It's unfortunate that the death rates in younger people are often related to a late diagnosis. So, Dr. Cannon, can you tell us a little bit about colon cancer itself, where it's located? And the colon is three or four parts, depending on how you look at it, I guess. So what is colon cancer? Where is it primarily located? And what do you see when you do a colonoscopy?
Those are good questions. So colon cancer is actually a malignancy that grows on the inside of your large intestines. And so most people would define the intestines starting at the stomach and then going through the small intestines and then finally dumping into the colon. And so it's the last five to six feet of your intestines before you evacuate. And so colon cancer is actually one of the most preventable cancers that we have through early detection and screening. So,
why do you surmise that colon cancer is increasing in young people and decreasing in older adults? I've read that the incidence of colorectal cancer in those younger than age 50 is expected to increase by 140% by the year 2030. That's a very scary statistic.
Yeah, so the incidence of colon cancer in young adults is definitely increasing. I kind of want to take a step back a little bit because it's still far more prevalent in the older population. So when you look at the age range between 40 and 50, the incidence is going up quickly, and it accounts for about 1 in 10 colon cancers currently. So that still means that 90% of the colon cancers are still in the elderly. But it is the fastest increasing. Like you said, it's going up by the fastest percent. It's not really declining in the elderly, but what we're seeing is, you know, there was a great study that was put out about 5 years ago, and it's actually made a big difference in the guidelines for colon cancer screening. But we're seeing this increase in the age 40 to 49 age range, and we're seeing a flattening of the curve in the people that are being screened. So what you're seeing is we're detecting and preventing colon cancers in the ages that we're actually screening. So is about 18 months ago or 2 years ago, the NCCN or the National Comprehensive Cancer Network recommended decreasing the age of initial screening from age 50 down to age 45. And so that's kind of been the standard for the last couple of years.
Now, I did see that it's now recommended to start at age 45. Do you think the increase in young people, again, is sort of this awareness, number one, better tests or easier tests or whatever? A lot of things in medicine we didn't know about until somebody, you know, really worked on developing a new test.
Correct.
So that's kind of just an interesting thought, I guess, as I was listening.
Well, I mean, you can maybe have that be a little bit of it, right? Because let's say, for instance, a patient had a colon cancer, and colon cancer typically is a slow-growing cancer, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not uncommon for somebody to have a colon cancer for 6 months to 18 months. We don't know, but six to 18 months before they come in and it gets diagnosed. Mm-hmm. So some of that, you know, the people who would have potentially been identified in the late 40s, you know, they would have, if they weren't screened until age 50, you know, it would have been picked up there. I mean, I do think that this is a real increase. I think because the numbers are growing. And I think, you know, part of it has to do with, we have a lot more GI diseases now, right? I mean, you think back 50, 70 years ago, I mean, hardly anybody knew anything about ulcerative colitis or inflammatory bowel disease or Crohn's disease or, you know,
celiac disease.
You know, those things are all things that have cropped up over the last, you know, 50 years. So, I mean, I think there's something real about it, and I think we don't know exactly what's causing it yet, whether it's partially diet, whether it is, you know, processed foods. I don't know the answer to that.
And we also do have better tests, because I remember I was a pediatrician, and celiac disease was noted to be in the Irish population, someone who's losing motor milestones. So at 9 months, 12 months, 15 months, they were losing milestones, and you needed to do 2 biopsies. You needed to do 1 for the diagnosis, then take them off all wheat products, and then do another one to see if it cured.
Yeah, for the confirmation.
Actually, 3, and then challenge them again and see if it came back. So that was a big, long evaluation, where now we have blood tests to do some of our routines or our screening of that disease. Are there certain populations that are represented in higher numbers in colon cancer?
You know, if you read the studies, they talk a lot about the Black population. They talk about low socioeconomics, and a lot of that has to do with, I think, access to care and perceived access to care. You know, there's a lot of different, and then the Ashkenazi Jews, there's always, I mean, it seems like there was definitely everything was stacked against them, right? I mean,
because
you can always, I mean, that's a huge population that always has.
It comes up in issues. A lot of questions.
A lot of board questions. Yep. Yeah. So.
And also, I've read that American Indians and Alaska Natives have a higher incidence, too. So, again, some of it, as we've kind of said, is some people don't get tested for a certain time, or they should at least be tested earlier. And I imagine genetics plays a large role in these conditions, but, again, as you mentioned, the decreased access to medical care and therefore to screening and testing plays a role in their mortality or their morbidity and mortality.
Well, so, you know, genetics is definitely plays a role, right? I mean, we screen people who have a family history of colon cancer a lot more frequently, you know, and so there's definitely a role in genetics. However, with colon cancer, 80% of all colon cancers are sporadic, you know, meaning there's no rhyme or reason. Yeah. Who's gonna get it, you know? And so that's why, you know, in the beginning, you have to come up with a good screening test to figure out, you know, who should be screened and who shouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's such a sporadic disease, you know, that's why we can't look at, you know, this person walking down the street and saying, oh, you're going to be fine. And this person over here, you know, you need to be screened a lot. Until we've got the genetic code completely decoded, we're not going to be able to do that right now. So,
and we ask family history for a lot of things. And sometimes I would get frustrated because either the parent didn't know, and I'm not really frustrated with that because that's an honest thing that happens. But they kind of gloss over it until they read in online and Dr. Google, and then they come and ask for tests.
Yeah.
When you're really interested in, really, did someone, we talked about this with heart disease, when we talked about heart disease, did someone, you know, drown before age 40 and they could have actually had a heart attack or, you know, fall and hit their head and have a really severe head injury, but they really had a heart attack.
What's interesting about that, too, that, you know, people not necessarily knowing, We're in a different time socially, right? Yeah. So the people that are, you know, and I'm 53, the people that are in my age, you know, my grandparents didn't talk about their health. That's and, right. You know, grandpa came back from the war and didn't talk about much, right? And so you know, he could have very well had colon cancer and we would have never known about it, you know?
Yeah. That's kind of what I was thinking about, too. In, you know, especially in the 20th century, there were so many advances. But if you were in 1910 or 1930 or 1950, you could have had colon cancer and were never diagnosed.
Exactly. I mean,
because
exactly
there wasn't the awareness of the risk factors. So we've talked about family history. What are other risk factors that are listed for colon cancer?
I mean, you can...
anything?
That's exactly. I mean, anything that you do, I mean, you know, a lot of times it's smoking, it's dietary, it's obesity, it is, you know, there's not one thing that you're just like, okay, this, I mean, obviously if you've got, we talked about this earlier with the ulcerative colitis and the Crohn's disease, the inflammatory bowel disease, you know, those are all things that are, that could lead you down the road to having, mm-hmm. you know, having colon cancer or being at risk for colon cancer.
Well, certainly the things that we try to help everyone with, lowering their fat content in their diet, working on obesity and smoking and high alcohol use.
The other one that we don't really think about is cured meats, though, has been shown. I mean, that's a pretty high risk, you know, the sandwich meats and the pork bellies and all that.
So all those salami that are really good buy in the grocery store now and make on your charcuterie tray.
Exactly.
Just to cut in for a moment, is that because of the preservatives
the nitrites. Mm-hmm. The nitrites within the meats, yeah.
Right. So I think they're trying to work on nitrite-free meats that mm-hmm. are those kind of meats preserved. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what do you think is the most successful way to get patients to modify their risk factors?
Are you really asking
that? That was a tough question. But, you know,
I can't modify my own risk factors, let alone, you know, I mean, education, we talk about that a lot, you know. We talk about, you know, you can just, all you can do is just give patients the information, right?
You can't follow them home.
Nope, can't follow them home. You give them, you know, like the big things. I try to give them behavior modification opportunities. One of the things I've gone to using frequently is for smoking cessation, I'll use acupuncture for those patients. And we used to have a hypnotist here in town that used to do a really nice job of getting people to stop. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, anything's on the table. You know, both my parents quit smoking with acupuncture and hypnosis. So, you know, I figure why not?
Very interesting. So, Susan, did you have any specific risk factors or how did you come to medical attention?
I didn't have any risk factors that I knew of. Well, I guess my doctor was always trying to get me to lose weight. So mm-hmm. when I hear what Dr. Canning said, I'm going, that was a risk factor.
Yeah.
But I went on a trip to see my daughter in September, in May. And it was just beginning of COVID. And so we had to wear the masks. And I came back really tired. And I thought it was from wearing the mask. I wasn't used to it. And I didn't feel better. So I went to my doctor. And in the process of checking me out, he said, well, you know, you were due last year for a colonoscopy. I went, oh! And he said, so, you know, we probably should do that this year. And what could I say? I missed my 10-year mark because my first year was so clear, I just thought I was scot-free. So I said, okay, and it came back stage 3 colon cancer.
Think how lucky you were that you had this discussion. And, you know, again, it's sort of like that incidental thing, the be feeling short of breath, and was it just from wearing a mask?
Mm-hmm.
And
then having
a doctor
that would not push, because at the 10-year mark, mm-hmm. it was suggested. I remember very clearly being in his office, and I was busy with some other stuff, and I was still flying on my first one. So mm-hmm. he was great, but the next time, when he suggested it, I did.
10 years goes by fast, doesn't
it?
It does.
Yeah, a lot can happen in 10 years.
Yeah.
So let's talk about symptoms in general. So if I was to be worried, again, did I feel short of breath? That's not usually a symptom. But what are other symptoms that relate to the colon and colon cancer specifically?
Yeah, so, you know, I suppose I would take a step back and even say, you know, the reason we do screenings is because we want to find it before we have symptoms, right? So the best thing is always to, you know, at age 45, start getting screened. They've got a lot of different screening tools, not just the colonoscopy. And some of them are appropriate and some of them aren't. And I think that's a good question to ask with your primary. So, you know, my recommendation is always, you know, start early, screen, you know, on time. Mm-hmm. But then if you're worried, like, you know, I have people all the time who come to me on a Monday morning and they're 68 years old and they've never had one, you know, and it doesn't mean that we're going to find something on everybody, mm-hmm. right? It's extremely rare, but, you know, I would say when you think about it, it's time to start screening. Mm-hmm. So then when you get into the symptoms, what are the symptoms of colon issues, you know, and it could be change in bowel habits. You know, sometimes you get bouts of diarrhea and you don't know why. Sometimes you can have a colon cancer that is almost obstructing, and in order for you to get stool past it, your body knows that it's got to have liquid stool and will give you diarrhea. Blood in your stools is always something mm-hmm. that, you know, a lot of times people will say, oh, I have hemorrhoids, you know, coming in for hemorrhoids, and it's not always hemorrhoids. So you've got, you know, obstructive type symptoms, change in bowel habits, change in the caliber. They talk about stools that are kind of the pencil thin, you know, kind of, and it's mm-hmm. all talking about, do we have this mechanical obstruction mm-hmm. going on? So
it's so interesting because I think back of, you know, different stool histories, basically. And, you know, when you think about variable, well, I mean, I've had variable, you know, I said something to one a gastroenterologist that was kind of like, you know, the 2-inch or 3-inch Tootsie Rolls.
Yeah.
You know, why does it go from that to a regular, you know, sort of stool? And basically, again, I was negative until I was telling Susan I decided to have my what I thought was my last one at 9 years instead of 10, and they found a precancerous polyp. So now I have to go back again in 3 years and drink the liquid crayon stuff again.
It's fun. It's a good time.
So, anyway, and again, then blood on the toilet paper, that's where I try to reassure people most of the time, because if you have blood up higher, it's not going to be bright red blood. So actually, it's more significant if you're testing for blood in the stool and you either see it on the stool or you don't even see it.
Just to cut in again, the good news is we have really great surgeons and doctors here in our community. And as you said, Dr. Canning, talk to your primary. Keep them informed of what you're experiencing and what's going on, and pay attention.
Mm-hmm. The most, not most serious, but one of the other things when we're talking about colon cancer is can actually be weight loss or fatigue, because if you've been losing blood for a while, you're going to be anemic. A low hemoglobin, low iron, people will describe it as, but it's basically that you've had blood loss and causing anemia, which causes fatigue. So, Susan, it sounds like you didn't really have those specific risk factors or those specific symptoms.
I didn't. Well, not that I, looking yeah. back, I can see, and listening to Dr. Canning, I can, you, hindsight, for what it's worth.
2020.
So I didn't. But after the colonoscopy, then surgery was scheduled mm-hmm. within the month.
Mm-hmm.
And so after 2 months, I went to see, after I got out of the hospital, I went to see the oncologist in January, and he said it looked like they got it all, but they never know. He said, That's not guarantee, but it looks like it. And he said, so let's start chemo. And it, to start that afternoon, they, and I said, oh, well, I was just starting to feel better. And I said, could I have the side effect sheets? And I think I better read those. And he gave me many pages. And I said, I think I'll go home and pray about this. And I took the sheets. And I went home and read them. And I said, I was just starting to feel better. I read the sheets. And I had met somebody in the hospital during, after surgery, who had had colon stage three 10 years before and hadn't done chemo. I'd never heard of that. So it was in my head. So I talked to my kids, my family, talked to him again, and just prayed a lot. And I thought, well, God created my body. Let's see if it can heal itself. So I went back and said, I'm not going to do the chemo. He was great. He didn't pressure me or anything. He just said, okay. And we talked a little bit about diet change. And he said, well, there are some studies out, but there wasn't a lot of information. So basically what I did was I changed my diet 100%. And when you're talking about the meats and you're talking about that, I took out everything, processed foods and sandwich meats, salami. But my biggest thing was sugar. I took out sugar. Mm-hmm. And so slowly my the markers stayed the same and I started to feel better. And so for me, it was a diet change. And then I found pickleball so I could exercise. And at my age, to be playing pickleball again was really wonderful. So a diet change, and the diet change changed my life.
Wow.
Because I had new energy and I felt better. I got off my blood pressure medication. And so I would suggest looking at your diet. And you mentioned diet. And so I would look at that.
So it was not no meat at all. It was no processed meat, like lunch meat and stuff.
Well, I had elk in the freezer, and I wasn't giving that up because there were no chemicals in it. So, no, it wasn't totally no meat, but it was the processed meat.
Very interesting. That's a really good lesson for everyone to hear, especially because of the there's also salt, and that affects blood pressure too. So that's a really good way to, you know, you were so successful in helping yourself, I guess.
And well, you talked about, Dr. Kenny was talking about, what can you do for your patients to encourage them? I wanted to say, scare them, because I'm a teacher, and so I've always believed, why didn't they just show us some pictures, some really good videos of you eat this, and this is going down, and this is what it's doing to your insides. I'm a very visual person, and that would have reached me. Mm-hmm. So I would like to see a whole series of, not even cartoons, but something real simple. You eat this, this is what happens to your body. And let people see what's happening inside of them, because the words don't always manifest the same in your brain as that picture does.
Well, that's how I said to you, too, that bringing someone in who had had colon cancer is so important, because people listen to stories, human interest stories, better than they retain statistics. Or, you know,
or listen to their doctors.
Yeah.
Or listen to their doctors.
Yes, you must do this. But the experiential part is better than the, like I said, the.
You know, there's a whole
big stick.
There's something that happens when they say you have cancer. And for me, it was, I think it might have been a little bit of denial, like, well, that can't be because I don't want that. But then after the diagnosis, you find people. It changes your frame of reference for people, and you find out all kinds of people. And so you have a new interest in it, and people are willing to share their information, and there is some good information out there. Nobody has it all, but I would encourage people to talk to other people who have the same, who have had the same diagnosis, and see what they did, and then weigh those options.
Those are great recommendations. Susie, do you have any more comments or questions now, or?
Well, just listening to this, it makes sense that paying attention to your body, eating, having a great lifestyle ahead of time, and then that early screening thing really hit home, 45 now. And or if you have some kind of symptoms, you would be even earlier. And it's not painful. It's not a bad process. You just get relief from not knowing. So that's what I came away with.
Wonderful. again, because colon cancer and the resultant deaths are preventable, we really do hope that increasing public awareness will make a change in. So, tell us about screening procedures and then diagnostic procedures. We talked about starting at 45, but there are, you know, we've heard about different tests. It still is, I think, the colonoscopy is the gold standard.
Gold standard, yep. So, I mean, there's essentially three stool tests and the colonoscopy. One of them is the one that everybody's familiar with. They go into their doctor. Their doctor does the digital rectal exam and smears the poop on a card and squirts some stuff on it and says, oh, yeah, you've got blood or you don't. Okay. It's a very poor surrogate for whether or not there's colon cancer. And then they updated that a little bit. It's very similar, but it was called the FIT test, looking for, some more specific colon cancers, colon type. It's a lot more specific to blood. With those, you still don't know where the blood's coming from. It could be coming from the stomach, could be coming from the colon. So when you get those and they're positive, you have to look in both. And then most recently, there's this cute little box on the television called the Cologuard, right? And he walks around and he tells you, all you have to do is poop in me and your life will be good. And that is actually a pretty decent test. It definitely has its limitations. That one is looking specifically for DNA markers, within the stool that that are related to colon cancer and to polyps. The limitations of that, and they put their data out there based on, like they said, colonoscopy being the gold standard, they still push that. It's not approved for people who have a family history of colon cancer. It's not approved for people who have had polyps or cancer in the past. So that takes a large subsection, and we're seeing a lot of those people, and Medicare is just sending everybody this Cologuard test. Medicare sends it, you do it, and you come back, and you're like, well, of course it was going to be positive. You had polyps, 2 years ago. Why are we doing this, right? You've been doing your colonoscopy, or your brother, you had colon cancer, So being able to use those tests appropriately is extremely important. And then that takes us to the colonoscopy, and the colonoscopy is the only test that we have that, and I would say mostly in almost all of medicine, it's the only test where you're looking and you are diagnosing and being therapeutic at the same time, which is what makes it such an important test, right? I mean, you've got the mammogram for breast cancer where you can diagnose it, but you can't do anything about it. With the colonoscopy, you're in there, you're seeing it, you're identifying a polyp, and you're removing it and essentially making that polyp not have the opportunity to turn into cancer in the future. So it's a very effective, very good test.
Okay. When Susan said she had some blood drawn, what would that have been?
Oh, for that?
Yeah.
That was it's a new test. Well, it's new for me.
Yeah.
It's called the Signature test. Are you familiar with that, Dr.
CT?
That's not one of them that I use.
CT DNA.
Yeah, it's probably, and I can't speak specifically to it, right? Good. But it's probably something that is utilized in people who have a diagnosis of cancer anyway, and it's going to be a surveillance type of test.
It's a comparison. They said they're taking my blood, and they're looking at the tumor they took. I said, they saved that?
Yes.
And they said, yes, they did, which was kind of
amazing.
Shocking to me. And then they looked to see if any of that tumor's in the blood that they take.
Oh, wow.
So we have lots of biomarkers that we use as surveillance. For colon cancer specifically, the one that we've used is called the CEA level. This is probably and just to let you know, I have not looked at this, so I don't know.
Yeah,
but
it's
part of the medical oncology follow-up. But it's probably something that is a lot more sensitive, specific version of that, where they're looking at the DNA of the actual colon cancer as opposed to markers that the that can be put out.
So. That's amazing. They could look at your actual cancer, probably the DNA. Just a sidelight before we move on. Did you have to have a repeat colonoscopy then within 6 months or a year?
Yes, I did.
Okay. And then they said it was whistle clean.
It was. Yeah. Thank you. That's a good word, whistle clean. That was encouraging.
Okay. You mentioned stage. So another aspect of medicine and cancer is that sometimes patients and their caregiver who comes don't always understand, because people go, oh, they're going to do a breast biopsy and tell her what stage it is. It's like, no, they're going to tell them what grade it is because they're looking at the cells in the tumor. The staging is more where it is or do you have metastases, correct? So do you want to talk a little bit about stage?
Staging is always, and the reason it's important to stage is it takes in three different aspects. It talks about the tumor itself, like how within the wall of the colon, you can look at it like a piece of PVC piping, and does it grow from all the way inside of that PVC piping and grow all the way outside, so from the inside out, right? Mm-hmm. And the farther it grows, as it's merging towards the outside of that pipe, it becomes a higher stage. So we grade it 1 through 4, mm-hmm. Okay? And then you look at the lymph nodes. And is there tumor within the lymph nodes? And it's not just a yes and no. It's more like how many lymph nodes do you have positive and everything. And then you look at the overall body, the metastasis, meaning is it outside the colon? Yeah. You know, is it in the liver? Is it in the lungs? Is it in the brain? Stuff like that. Right. And so you combine all of those together, and you come up with a staging system. Mm-hmm. And based on the specific stage, we have lots of clinical data over lots of years that will kind of give you what we call the 5-year survival rate. And it doesn't mean that that's yours. It just means if you look at the whole patient population that has your type of tumor, your expected survival rate is X, mm-hmm. you know, based on whatever stage. Mm-hmm. That all goes into the medical oncology. Would you benefit, you know, here's your 5-year survival, disease-free survival without chemotherapy, here's your 5-year survival with chemotherapy, and then it goes into your, you know, helps you with your decision, you know, and so, yeah.
And this lady beat the odds.
yeah.
So again, what I remember specifically from staging is like stage 4, you have tumor on both sides of the diaphragm. I assume that's still correct.
Stage 4 is, so for colon cancer, it's just, is it distant to the colon?
Okay, distant.
Okay, so okay, if it's in the liver, it's a stage 4.
Okay.
Okay. If it's in the peritoneum, it's a stage 4. So both sides of the diaphragm, that a lot of time that's used for like lymphoma and stuff like that. Yeah.
Okay. So how did you get to stage 3, Susan?
I don't know.
Was it lymph nodes?
Well, it would have been how many lymph nodes they took out.
Okay.
And they, you know, at the time, they're telling you all this stuff. It's a foreign language. Yeah. So I think Dr. Cannon can explain that a lot better than me.
Stage 3 is essentially, it's colon cancer that is inside the lymph nodes. We identify that at the time of the surgical removal, mm-hmm. and it has not spread anywhere else. So we know that it had escaped outside the colon itself, was traveling along the lymph nodes, and typically we recommend chemotherapy for that based on the fact that we know that there are small cells that could be floating around elsewhere. And so systemic chemotherapy would help to kind of essentially sterilize the cells that might be floating around. So,
So again, it's a multidisciplinary team. You've had your internist, your gastroenterologist, your general surgeon, and then the oncologist. Do they ever do radiation?
Not for colon, but they do for rectal.
Okay.
So rectal cancer, you would get would probably get radiation ahead of time. Yeah.
Okay. So that's the lower part of your large intestine.
Yeah, for sure.
I did note some survival statistics when I was doing a little background reading. So stage one and stage two had a 91% survival, so that means 5 years. Mm-hmm. Stage three was 73%, but stage four is down to 16%.
So, correct.
That's the importance, again, of doing things early and getting your screening. To summarize, our most important take-home message is that colorectal cancer is preventable and treatable with early diagnosis.
Potentially curable, too, right? Yeah. I mean, if we get it early enough, we're talking cure, not just treatment. So
that, I think, is really important to reiterate, because I heard that from my doctor, my regular doctor. He was very positive about this is good, we've caught it at a good time. And he gave me that encouragement that it was curable. And I think sometimes you get so scared that you don't see that. And stress is not a good thing when you have cancer. Yeah. So I appreciate Dr. Canning reiterating
that.
Yeah,
and your attitude, your psychological attitude is really important. So the best advice to patients is sort of what you just said, is to keep up with your with your colonoscopies, or just as you talked about, changing your diet and getting more activity. I mean, you've really made such remarkable improving your quality of life, mm-hmm. I guess, and not decreasing your quality of life by having a cancer diagnosis. Mm-hmm. Anything else? Any you would like to add?
No.
Okay, well, I just thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate having this discussion with a great general surgeon and a very knowledgeable patient.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is 88.5 KRFY, and we're listening to Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne. And hi, Dr. Joanne.
Hi there.
We just had some guests talking about colon cancer. And, you know, what hit me also, besides the fact that early screening and curable with early screening, that was a great thing to hear, but also the fact that a colonoscopy is not all that bad. We've all agreed to that. So don't worry about that, folks.
No, it depends on what prep you get. And some people are so excited because they get the small bottle of stuff, but drinking the big liter, the big whatever, 4 liter one.
It's not that bad.
It's okay.
Yeah. So what else do we have to talk about?
Okay, we're going
to
change gears a bit. There are so many different medical designations for every month of the year. I chose National Poison Prevention Week to talk about because it's really important for all age groups. It's March 17th to March 23rd specifically. And I really just want to remind our listeners that there is a national number for poisoning information. It's 1-800-222-1222. And post it on your refrigerator with the children's art, post it in your bathroom, you know, have it in your wallet. It's just so, so very important. And when you do call, it's also important to know what the person has ingested or inhaled. Because treatments are different depending on the substance. I remember, especially in pediatrics, if a child would ingest something that's caustic, meaning it's going to burn your esophagus as it's going down, you don't want to give them a medicine that makes them throw up, because then you'll get burned again. So knowing what it is important, but even if you don't know, please do call our National Poison Prevention number. Poison prevention applies to all ages, infants, toddlers, school-age kids, adults, and the elderly. About 30 children die each year from poisonings, and 9 out of 10 accidental poisonings occur in the home. So I always say to the parents that I'm working with, what's under your sink? You know, you have common cleaning items that have certain toxicity to humans. So what's under your sink? Use your cabinet locks if there are young children in the home, but you can also make your own less toxic products by using vinegar, baking soda, and dish soaps. Not that dish soap would taste good, but at least would not be as toxic as some of our other cleaning solutions. Another favorite question of mine is, what's in grandma's purse? What's in mom's purse? What's in aunt's purse, or sibling, or a friend? Medicine bottles without a child lock are certainly accessible, but even with child locks, some kids can open medicine bottles with child locks easier than arthritic adults can, or even non-arthritic adults. It's like, how did they open that? For school kids and above, we kind of worry about what's the newest fad for daring other kids. Are they experimenting with drugs? Or are they finding prescription drugs, again, in the medicine cabinet and just trying them? Then we get to our younger adult, our young adults and our older adults, and we've heard so much recently about illegal drug use, about fentanyl. It's so important to know the availability of naloxone or Narcan in your community. Some places you can get it at the police station, you get it at the pharmacy without a prescription. Smoking, vaping, drinking the vaping solution. I mean, kids can get into all kinds of things, or again, young adults or people that really have this need for medicine. The abuse of prescription medicines it certainly contributes also to poisoning. And then for the elderly, we have poor eyesight, decreasing memory, which leads to accidental overdoses. Carbon monoxide is no color, no smell, so every home should have a carbon monoxide detector. We get carbon monoxide from cars, appliances, furnaces, anything that might have a leak of some kind. Another interesting statistic I found as I was preparing is there are 2 million calls to the Poison Control Center every year. Someone calls a poison center every 12 seconds, and they are open 24/7, so you can call at any time. There are approximately 80,000 emergency department visits due to poisonings. There probably are many more because not everyone comes to the ER, and not everyone, again, knows why they got to the ER. They might have collapsed, and they wouldn't know that it was due to ingesting a poisonous substance. So again, the number to record and have available, 1-800-222-1222.
So good information, very important information. Sounds like we should repeat that number again. This is the place you can call, 1-800-222-1222.
That's correct. They're just in general, I hope the information that we gave out today is useful to all of you. Do remember that this is simply medical information, and if you have some true medical concern about yourself, call your doctor or get a doctor. We are not giving out medical advice, but hopefully medical information that you can use. Next month, we'll be talking, in April, we'll be talking about autism, and it's also National Infant Immunization Week. So hope you tune in again in April, and we'll be back with another Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne.
I just want to quickly say thank you so much, Dr. Joanne, for taking on this show and hosting it here at 88.5 KRFY. And to our listeners, thank you for listening.